or preparation. I tightened the tourniquet, grasped the sharpest knife, nodded to my helpers, and began. A deep incision, fast, around, and across the top of the leg, cutting hard down to expose the bone. An army surgeon could lop off a leg in less than 2 minutes. So could I, but it would be better if I could manage to cut flaps to cover the stump, could seal the major vessels. "Big needle," I said to Peggy, holding out my hand. Lacking a tenaculum to seize the large blood vessels that snapped back into the flesh when severed, I had to probe for them with the point of the needle and drag them out, anchor them into the raw, exposed flesh, and then ligate them as fast as I could, whipping thread around them with one of the smaller needles and tying it off. Better than cautery, if there was time. Sweat was running into my eyes. I had to dash it away with my bared forearm. My hands were bloody to the wrist. "Saw," I said, and no one moved. Had I spoken aloud? "Saw," I said, much louder, and Jamie's head twisted toward the implements on the table. Leaning heavily on Tench's leg with one hand, he stretched to grab the saw from the table with the other. Where was Peggy? On the floor. I saw the bloom of her skirt from the corner of my eye, and felt vaguely through the floorboards the steps of a servant coming to haul her out of the way. I groped for another suture, blind, and the jar of brandy in which I'd stowed them tipped, spilling on the sheet and adding its sweet stickiness to the atmosphere. I heard Jamie gag, but he didn't move. His fingers squeezed the thigh hard above the tourniquet. Tench would have bruises there, I thought idly, if he lived long enough for his capillaries to bleed. The saw had been made to disjoint hogs. Sturdy, not sharp, and not well kept. Half the teeth were bent, and it jumped and skittered in my hand, grating over the bone. I clenched my teeth and pushed, my hand slipping on the handle, greased with blood and sweat. Jamie made a deep, desperate noise, and moved suddenly, taking the saw from my hand and nudging me aside. He gripped Tench's knee and bore down on the saw, driving it into the bone by main force. 3, 4, 5 dragging noises, and the bone, 3/4 sawn through, made a cracking noise that jolted me into action. "Stop," I said, and he did, white-faced and pouring sweat. "Lift his leg, carefully." He did, and I made the cut from below, long, deep strokes of the knife deepening the incision at an angle to make the flap, joining the cut with the upper incision. The sheet was wet and dark with blood, but not too much. Either the tourniquet was holding, or the man had so little blood left to lose. "Saw again," I said urgently, discarding the knife. "Hold steady. Both pieces." There was no more than a thin section of bone remaining. The spongy bone of the marrow showed, blood flowering slowly from the cut surface. I put no pressure on the saw. The last thing I wanted was to crack the bone in some awkward way. It wasn't working, though, and I looked back toward the line of tools, desperate to find something else. "Rasp," Jamie said, his voice rough with strain. He nodded toward the table. "There." I seized the rasp, a rat-tailed thing, drenched it with brandy, and turning it sideways, filed through the last bit of bone, which parted gently, with a ragged edge, but intact, not shattered. "Is he breathing?" I asked. I was having trouble breathing myself, and couldn't sense the patient's vital signs, save to notice his heart was beating, because blood was pulsing slightly out of the smaller vessels. But Arnold nodded, his head bowed, intent on Tench's face. "He'll do," he said, his voice firm and loud, and I knew he was speaking as much to Tench as to me. Now I could feel the stir in the upper leg, a violent reflexive urge to move, and Jamie leaned hard on it. My fingers brushed the discarded lower leg, the flesh horribly flaccid and rubbery, and I snatched them back, wiping them convulsively on my apron. I swiped the bloody apron then across my face, and pushed back loosened bits of hair with the back of my hand. It was shaking. They both were. "What the bloody hell are you shaking now for?" I thought irritably. But I was, and it took much longer than it should have to cauterize the last few small bleeders, adding the ghastly smell of roasting flesh to everything else in the room. I thought even General Arnold might throw up. Stitch the flaps, bandage the wound, and at last loosen the tourniquet. All right, I said, and straightened up. Now, but if I said anything else, I didn't hear it. The room revolved slowly round me and dissolved into a flicker of black and white spots. Then everything went black. Chapter 118. The Second Law of Thermodynamics. Tench lived. I should have known you would, I said to him. If you were determined enough to survive all night in the river, plainly a mere amputation wouldn't slow you down. He hadn't enough strength to laugh. The journey by litter to Chestnut Street had left him white-faced and gasping. But he did twitch his mouth enough to qualify his expression as a smile. Oh, I'll live, he managed. Wouldn't give 'em the satisfaction of dying. Worn out by this, he closed his eyes, chest heaving. I wiped his face gently with my handkerchief, patted his shoulder, and left him to rest. I had had the litter bearers take him upstairs to what had been my bedroom, and I closed the door behind me now with a queerly mixed feeling of triumph and depression. I had spent the morning with Mrs. Fig and the housemaid Doreen, packing away what remained of Lord John's furnishings, for many had already been shipped to New York, and rearranging the house to serve as a temporary surgery. Even if we were to leave for North Carolina soon, and the sooner the better, I did have some place to put Tench where he could be looked after in conditions approaching comfort and hygiene. And the patients I'd been seeing at the print shop could certainly be taken care of more conveniently here. At the same time, being here again brought back echoes of the numb despair I had lived with all those weeks of believing Jamie dead. I thought the bustle of work and the clean sweep of furnishings would perhaps obviate that distant sense of drowning. But at the moment, it was an uneasy swirl around my ankles. Mental oppression was not the only debilitating condition connected with the new situation. Leaving number 17 to return to the ship and house, I had been followed in the street by a gang of young men. Mostly boys, but some big fellows of 16 or 17, big enough to make me uneasy with their glances. Still more uneasy when they began to draw up close to me, taking a quick step to whisper, King's whore, in my ear before falling back, or trying to tread on the hem of my skirt, sniggering. I thought I'd seen one or two of them in the mob when I brought Hal here. Perhaps they'd followed me then, and finding that I was married to Lord John, assumed I was a turncoat, a traitor to the rebel cause. Or possibly, I thought, stiffening my spine, they were just troublemaking pipsqueaks. I whirled round to face them, gripping my parasol. It wasn't much of a weapon, but no physical weapon would have been of use against so many. Even a 12-year-old boy was likely stronger than I was at the moment. What do you want? I demanded, using the memory of my matron's voice, whip-crack and steel. Or at least, I hoped I could still do that. Some of the little warts blinked and took a step back, but one of the bigger ones took a step toward me, grinning. It took all my control not to recoil. I don't know, Hinny, he said, looking me up and down with a lazy insolence. What does a loyalist lady have that we might want? A swift poke in the eye is all I can offer you, I informed him crisply, with a meaningful pointing of my parasol. Apparently I'm walking too slowly and blocking your progress, gentlemen. Do go on ahead of me. Holding his eye with a menacing stare, I stepped into the street and gestured with my parasol, indicating that they should pass on. That made some of them giggle, but the big fellow flushed a nasty pink that made his adolescent pimples fluoresce. I stepped back farther into the street, in an imitation of politeness, but actually in hopes of attracting some attention. I was lucky. A rag and bone cart was coming down the road, the horse's hooves clopping on the cobbles, and I moved still farther, blocking the way. The carter, aroused from semi-somnolence, half stood, peering out from under his hat.
"What the devil are you idle buggers a-doing in the road? Get your fat asses out of my way."
He raised his whip in a menacing fashion, and the boys, who had started to advance on me, quickly retreated. The carter stood up all the way, took off his hat, and bowed to me.
"Good day, your ladyship. I hopes I sees you well. Can I offer you a ride, mayhap?"
He was speaking in jest. I didn't think he actually knew I had recently been a ladyship. He was certainly surprised when I swept up my skirts and mounted his cart, though.
"Home, James," I said, furling my parasol, "and don't spare the horses."
The recollection made me smile a little, but the smile faded at the thought that the louts who had accosted me certainly lived somewhere nearby. I mightn't be as lucky a second time. And at that thought, a wave of cold terror washed over me, and I felt a band of soreness across my middle. The chafing and bruising from hours spent tied face down across a horse's back, being carried helpless to... "Stop that," I said sharply to myself. "Stop it at once. I won't have it." They were teenaged boys. I wasn't afraid of... But the first man to rape me had been about 16. He'd been apologetic about it. I stepped into a narrow alleyway between two buildings and threw up. I'd managed to function. I got back to the Shippen's house and collected my things, then returned to the print shop to eat lunch and pack up the rest of my herbs and medicines. Fergus and Germaine would bring them to Chestnut Street on their afternoon delivery round. No one had molested me on the way back to Chestnut Street. I could have asked Jenny to come with me, but pride prevented me. I would not let simple-minded fear stop me doing what needed to be done. But how long can you keep doing it? And what's the point? "There's always a point," I muttered. "It's someone's life. That's a point." A life that could be snatched away, thrown away, frittered on a battlefield. How many men had died that way? And it didn't stop. It didn't get better. This was an early war, for God's sake. An endless chain of wars lay between my lives. The revolution here, the great war at the other end, and constant slaughter in between. The summer was dying. The air was beginning to have a hint of freshness in the mornings, but in mid-afternoon it still hung thick and heavy. Too heavy to draw a full breath. I stood for a moment outside number 17, feeling unequal to going in and dealing with things. After a moment, I turned down the path that led round the side of the house, out to the tiny garden at the back, and sat down on the bench there, among the roses, feeling most unwell. I don't know how long I'd been sitting there, head in my hands, listening to the loud buzzing of bees, but I heard footsteps coming down the path and managed to lift my head.
"Are you all right, Sassenach?"
It was Jamie, the large box of medicines and bandages in his arms. And from the look of alarm on his face, it was reasonably obvious that I didn't look all right. I couldn't muster the energy to try to look all right. "I just thought, I'd sit down," I said, flapping a hand helplessly.
"I'm glad you did."
He set down the box on the yellowing grass and came to crouch in front of me, examining my face.
"What happened?"
"Nothing," I said, and without warning began to cry, or rather, to leak. There was nothing of the sobbing, convulsive, racking nature of weeping. Tears were just streaking down my cheeks without my approval. Jamie nudged me over a little and sat down beside me, wrapping his arms around me. He was wearing his old kilt, and the smell of the dusty wool fabric, worn thin with age, made me utterly dissolve. He tightened his grip and, sighing, pressed his cheek to my head and said small, tender things in Gaelic. And in a little time, the effort to understand them gave me a tenuous grip on myself. I drew a deep breath, and he released me, though he kept an arm around me for support.
"Money and done," he said softly,
and smoothed hair out of my face.
"Have you got a hunky?"
That made me laugh, or rather emit a sort of strangled giggle, but still, yes. At least, I think so. I groped in my bosom and withdrew a sturdy square of much-laundered linen, on which I blew my nose several times, and then wiped my eyes, trying to think what on earth to offer as an explanation for my disordered state, of mind as well as body. There wasn't any good way to begin, so I just began. "Do you ever..."
"Well, no, I know you do."
"Likely," he said, smiling a little.
"What do I do?"
"See the void? The abyss?" Speaking the words reopened the rent in my soul, and the cold wind came through. A shudder ran through me, in spite of the warmth of the air and Jamie's body. I mean, it's always there, always yawning at your feet. But most people manage to ignore it, not think about it. I've mostly been able to. You have to do medicine. I wiped my nose on my sleeve, having dropped my handkerchief. Jamie pulled a crumpled hanky out of his sleeve and handed it to me.
"You dinna mean only death?" he asked. "Because I've seen that often enough. It hasn't really scared me since I was 10 or so, though."
He glanced down at me and smiled.
"And I doubt you're afraid of it either. I've seen you face it down 1,000 times and more."
"Facing something down doesn't mean you aren't afraid of it," I said dryly. "Usually quite the opposite. And I know you know that." He made a small sound of agreement in his throat and hugged me gently. I would normally have found this comforting, and the fact that I didn't merely added to my sense of despair. It's just nothing. And so much endless nothing. It's as though nothing you do, nothing you are, can possibly matter. It's all just swallowed up. I closed my eyes, but the darkness behind my eyelids frightened me, and I opened them again. I raised a hand, then let it fall. "I can't explain," I said, defeated. "It wasn't there, or I wasn't looking at it, after I was shot. It wasn't nearly dying that made me look in, see it yawning there, but being so bloody frail, being so stinking afraid." I clenched my fists, seeing the knobby bones of my knuckles, the blue veins that stood out on the backs of my hands and curved down my wrists. "Not death," I said at last, sniffing. "Futility. Uselessness. Bloody entropy. Death matters. At least sometimes."
"I get that,"
Jamie said softly, and took my hands in his. They were big and battered, scarred and maimed.
"It's why a warrior doesn't fear death so much. He has the hope, sometimes the certainty, that his death will matter."
"What happens to me between now and then doesn't matter to anyone." Those words swam out of nowhere and struck me in the pit of the stomach so hard that I could barely breathe. He'd said that to me, from the bottom of despair, in the dungeon of Wentworth Prison a lifetime ago. He'd bargained for my life then with what he had, not his life already forfeit. But his soul. "It matters to me," I'd said to him, and against all odds had ransomed that soul and brought him back. And then it had come again, stark and dire necessity, and he'd laid down his life without hesitation for his men and for the child I carried. And that time I had been the one who sacrificed my soul, and it had mattered for both of us. It still mattered. And the shell of fear cracked like an egg, and everything inside me poured out like blood and water mingled, and I sobbed on his chest until there were no more tears and no more breath. I leaned against him, limp as a dishcloth, and watched the crescent moon begin to rise in the east. "What did you say?" I said, rousing myself after a long while. I felt groggy and disoriented, but at peace.
I asked, "What's entropy?"
"Oh," I said, momentarily disconcerted. When had the concept of entropy been invented?
Not yet, obviously.
It's, a lack of order, a lack of predictability, an inability for a system to do work.
A system of what?
Well, there you have me, I admitted, sitting up and wiping my nose. Just an ideal sort of system, with heat energy. The second law of thermodynamics basically says that in an isolated system, one that's not getting energy from somewhere outside, I mean, entropy will always increase. I think it's just a scientific way of saying that everything is going to pot all of the time. He laughed, and despite my shattered state of mind, I did too.
Ah, well, far be it from me to argue with the second law of thermodynamics, he said. I think it likely right.
When did you last eat, Sassnach?
I don't know, I said. I'm not hungry. I didn't want to do anything but sit still beside him.
Do you see the sky? He said, a little later.
It was a pure deep violet at the horizon, fading into a blue-black immensity overhead, and the early stars burned like distant lamps.
Hard to miss, I said.
Aye.
He sat with his head tilted back, looking up, and I admired the clean line of his long, straight nose, his soft, wide mouth and long throat, as though seeing them for the first time.
Is it not a void there?
He said quietly, still looking up.
And yet we're no afraid to look.
There are lights, I said. It makes a difference. My voice was hoarse and I swallowed.
I suppose even the stars are burning out, according to the second law. Well, I suppose men can make all the laws they like, he said. But God made hope. The stars will na burn out.
He turned, and cupping my chin, kissed me gently.
And nor will we.
The noises of the city were muted now, though even darkness didn't stifle it entirely. I heard distant voices and the sound of a fiddle, a party perhaps, from one of the houses down the street. And the bell of St. George's struck the hour with a small, flat bong. 9 o'clock, and all's well. I'd better go and see to my patient, I said. Chapter 119. Alas, poor Yorick. September the 17th, 1778, Middlebrook Encampment, New Jersey. 2 nights later, William stood at the edge of a dark wood, watching a lopsided rising moon shed its light over Middlebrook Encampment. His heart was thumping in his ears, and he was breathing fast, his hands clenched around the handle of the spade he'd just stolen. He'd been correct in his assessment of his welcome. He'd roughened his accent, and posing as a young immigrant from England, interested in joining Washington's troops, he'd been invited to join the Hamilton family for supper, and given a bed for the night. The next day he'd walked up to Middlebrook Encampment with the eldest Hamilton's son, a man about his own age, where he'd been introduced to a Captain Ronson, one of the few officers still there. One thing had led to another, and by degrees he had steered the conversation to the battle at Brandywine Creek, and thence to British prisoners of war, and eventually he'd been taken to the small burying ground that lay before him now. He'd been cautious about Ben, mentioning his name only casually among several others. Family acquaintances, he'd said, that he'd heard had been at the battle. Some of the men he'd talked to hadn't recognised the name at all. Two or three said, "Oh, yes, the English Viscount. Prisoner, billeted with a family called Tobermory. Very civil fellow. Shame that he died." And one man, a Lieutenant Corrie, had said the same thing, but his eyes had flickered slightly when he said it. William was wise enough to abandon the subject at once, but brought up Captain Benjamin Grey with someone else much later and out of hearing of Corrie. "Is he buried nearby?" he'd asked with a decent assumption of casual concern. "I know his family. I should like to be able to write to them, tell them I'd visited, you know." It had taken some effort. The burying ground was well outside the encampment, up on a little wooded knoll, and while some of the graves were neatly ranked, others had been dug hastily, and many were unmarked. His companion was not busy, though, and of a helpful complexion. He went and unearthed the adjutant's ledger in which the dead were listed, and with some poking about, eventually led William to a flattened mound with a piece of lath stuck into it, on which Grey had been scratched with a nail.
"Lucky you came before another winter got at it," his companion had remarked, pulling the lath out and examining it critically.
He shook his head, reached into his pocket, and, fetching out a lead pencil, reinforced the name with strong scrubbing strokes before pushing it back into the earth.
"Maybe that will last a bit, in case the family should want to set up a stone."
"That's very good of you," William had said, his throat tight. "I'll tell his family of your kindness."
But he couldn't weep for a man he theoretically hadn't known, and so swallowed his emotions, and turned away, finding something commonplace to talk about as they made their way downhill. He had wept in private later, leaning against the comforting bulk of the mare whom he'd named Miranda. She wasn't sprightly, but she was a good horse, and merely woofed a bit and shifted her weight to give him support. He'd been stubbornly insisting to himself that there must be some mistake. Ben couldn't be dead. This belief had been sustained by Uncle Hal's complete refusal to believe the news. And it was plausible. Whatever Ezekiel Richardson was up to, he meant no good to the Greys. But here was Ben's grave, silent and muddy, speckled with the first yellowing leaves of September. And all around him lay the decaying bodies of other men, some prisoners, some Continental regulars, some militia, equal and equally alone in death. He'd eaten dinner that night with the Hamiltons again, replying automatically to their conversation, but concerned with his own misery, and the thought of the much greater misery to come when he had to return to New York and tell his father and Uncle Hal. William had taken leave of the Hamiltons next morning, consigning the remains of the deer to them, and was followed down the narrow road by their good wishes and hopes that they would see him again with General Washington when the troops came back to Middlebrook to winter. He'd made it several miles down the mountain, dragging his spirit behind him, when he stopped to take a piss. He'd been hunting once with Ben, and they'd stopped like this. Ben had told him a particularly scabrous joke, and he'd laughed so much that he couldn't piss. And Ben had pissed on his shoes, which made them both laugh harder, and... "God damn it," he said aloud, and buttoning his flies, stamped back to Miranda and swung up into the saddle. "I'm sorry, old lass," he said, reining her head round to face uphill. "We're going back." And here he was, wavering between the conviction that this was madness and the stark fact that there wasn't anything else he could do besides go back to New York, and he wouldn't do that until and unless he had no other choice. At least he might be able to salvage a lock of Ben's hair for Aunt Minnie. That thought made him want to throw up, but he touched the knife at his waist, took a firmer hold of the spade, and made his way gingerly in among the graves. The moonlight was bright enough to find footing, but not to read most of the markers. He had to kneel and run his thumb over several before feeling the letters G-R-E-Y.
Right, he said out loud.
His voice sounded small and choked, and he cleared his throat and spat to the side, not on the grave.
Right, he said again,
more forcefully, and standing, took up the spade and drove it into the earth. He'd started close to what he thought should be the head, but dug in from the side. The thought of driving his spade down into Ben's face made his flesh creep. The dirt was soft, damp with recent rain, but it was heavy work, and despite the coolness of the mountain night, he was soaked with sweat before he'd dug a quarter of an hour. If Ben had died of camp fever, as they said, and come to think, was that sensible? He hadn't been held in the stockade with the enlisted men. As an officer, he'd been billeted with the Tobermorys. How had he come to catch camp fever? But still, if he had, then others would have died at the same time. It was a badly infectious sort of plague, he knew that much. But if that were true, then a number of other men would have been buried at the same time, and buried hastily, to prevent contagion from the bodies.
Oh, there was a good thought. He might be opening a grave full of teeming pestilence. Anyway, if that were the case, the graves would be shallow ones.
This one was. His spade struck something harder than dirt, and he stopped abruptly, muscles quivering. He swallowed and resumed shoveling, more cautiously. The body had been wrapped in a shroud of coarse burlap. He couldn't see, but a ginger probing with his fingers told him as much. Squatting, he dug with his hands, unearthing what he hoped was the head. His stomach was clenched tight, and he was breathing through his mouth. The stink was less than he'd expected, but still definitely there. Oh, God. Ben. He'd been nursing the hope that the grave was empty. Patting and probing, he made out the rounded shape and took a deep breath, feeling for the edge of the shroud. Had it been stitched? No, the edge was loose. He'd thought of bringing a torch, but had dismissed the idea, not wanting to risk detection. On the whole, he was glad he hadn't. He wiped dirt from his hands onto his breeches and peeled the burlap gently back, grimacing as it stuck to the skin beneath. It came loose with a grisly, rasping sound, and he nearly dropped it and ran. But he steeled himself and touched the dead man's face. It wasn't as awful as he thought it might be. The body seemed largely still intact.
How long will a man lie the earth ere he rot?
What if the gravedigger said in reply? 9 years.
Well, then.
He'd seen Hamlet with Ben and Adam in London. William fought back an insane urge to laugh and felt gently over the dead features. The nose was broad and stubby. Not Ben's sharp beak, but no doubt the process of decay. He slid his fingers over the temple, thinking to see if a presentable lock of hair might... and stopped dead, not breathing. The corpse was missing an ear. Bloody hell, it was missing both ears. He felt again, both sides, unable to believe it. But it was true, and the ears had been missing for some time. Even with the nasty slack feel of the decaying flesh, the ridges of scar tissue were distinct. A thief. William sat back on his heels and tilted up his head, letting out a huge breath. He felt dizzy, and the stars made little pinwheels in his vision. Jesus, he breathed, flooded with relief, gratitude, and creeping horror. Oh, Jesus, thank you. And, oh, Christ, he added, looking down at the invisible stranger in Ben's grave. Now what? Chapter 120. A Crackling of Thorns. September the 18th, 1778. Philadelphia. I was having a pleasantly incoherent dream involving autumn leaves and fireflies. The fireflies were red rather than green, and were floating down through the trees like live sparks, and where they brushed against the yellow leaves, the edges browned and curled as the leaves caught fire. Smoke curled upward through the trees, lazy against an evening sky, pungent as tobacco, and I was walking underneath, smoking a cigarette with Frank. I woke muzzily, thinking how nice it was to see Frank again, followed abruptly by, "Dreams don't smell, do they?" along with, "I don't smoke," and then, "Jesus, we're on fire." I sat up, panicked, and wriggling to get out of the sheets. Smoke was already thick in the loft, drifting layers above my head, and Jamie was coughing, grabbing my arm and dragging me free before I could locate all my limbs. "Quick," he said, hoarse as a crow. "Dinner wait to dress. Come down." I didn't dress, but did seize my shift and pulled it over my head as I crawled toward the edge of the loft. Jamie had the ladder over the edge as I reached it, and was already started down, shouting in a loud, cracked voice. I could hear the fire. It rattled and crackled, and the ashy smell of burning paper and the stink of singed buckram was thick in the air. "In the shop," I gasped, catching up with Jamie in the kitchen. "It's in the shop. The Bibles are burning. The type foundry."
"Get the wains."
He ran across the kitchen, shirt tails flying, and slammed shut the door that led into the print shop, from which smoke was fuming in clouds. I ran the other way, into the room that served Fergus and Masali as living and sleeping quarters, with a smaller loft above, where the children and Jenny slept. That door was shut, thank God. The smoke hadn't yet reached them. I flung it open, shouting, "Fire! Fire! Get up! Get up!" and ran for the ladder to the loft, hearing Fergus swear behind me in French, and Masali's confused, "What? What?" My hands were sweating and slipped on the smooth wooden rails of the ladder. "Jenny! Germaine!" I bellowed, or tried to. Smoke was drifting here too, high up under the roof, and I was coughing, my eyes and nose running.
"Joan!"
There was one small bedstead, two little humps under the bedclothes. I ran to the bed, flinging back the covers. Joan and Félicité were curled together, Félicité's nightdress rucked up to show her little bottom. I grabbed her by the shoulder, shaking her and trying to speak calmly. "Girls, girls, you have to get up, right now. Do you hear me, Joan? Wake up." Joan's eyelids were fluttering and she was coughing, turning her head to and fro to escape the smoke, eyes stubbornly closed. Félicité normally slept like the dead, and tonight was no exception. Her head wobbled like her rag doll's when I shook her.
"What? What is it?"
Jenny was struggling out of the quilts on her pallet in the corner. "We're on fire," I shouted. "Hurry, help me." I heard a cracking noise from the kitchen and a scream from Masali. I didn't know what had happened, but in desperation I grabbed Félicité bodily out of bed, still shouting at Joan to wake up, for God's sake. I felt the vibration of the ladder against the loft, and Jamie was there, snatching Joan up out of the bed.
"The lads, where are the lads?" he asked urgently.
In the frantic need to wake the girls, I'd forgotten Germaine and Henri Christian. I looked round in an urgent daze. There was a thin mattress on the floor, flattened and dented by bodies, but no sign of the boys.
"Germaine? Joan? Henri Christian?"
Masali's face popped up over the edge of the loft, pale with fear.
"Félicité!"
In an instant she was with me, taking Félicité from me. The little girl was coughing and whining, starting to cry.
"It's all right, Anian. It's all right. You're safe, aye?"
Masali was patting her back, coughing herself as the smoke thickened.
"Where are the boys?"
Jamie had shoved Jenny onto the ladder and was following her down, Joan draped over his shoulder, small pink feet kicking urgently. "I'll find them," I said, pushing Masali toward the ladder. "Take Félicité down." Something in the shop exploded with a loud whoosh. Probably a barrel of ink made with varnish and lamp black. Masali gasped, clutched Félicité hard, and scuttled for the ladder. I began rootling madly through the bits of furniture and boxes and bags in the loft, calling the boys' names between fits of coughing. The smoke was much worse now. I could barely see. I was kicking my way through blankets, a chamber pot, unfortunately full, and other things, but there was no sign of Henri Christian or Germaine. even if they had been overcome by the smoke, surely.
Sassenach!
Jamie was suddenly there by my elbow.
Come down, come down! The fire's in the wall, the loft will come down any minute.
But he didn't wait for argument, but picked me up bodily and swung me down onto the ladder. I missed my footing and slid the last few feet, knees buckling as I hit the floor. The wall in front of me was alight, plaster shattered and the fire moving, glowing along the edges of the laths. Jamie landed beside me with a thud that shook the floor, seized my arm, and we ran for the kitchen. I heard a rending crack, and then a crash that seemed to happen in slow motion as the supports to the children's loft gave way and the timbers came down.
Jermaine? I gasped. Henri?
Not here, Jamie said,
and shook with coughing.
Out! We must get out!
The air in the kitchen was a little clearer, but not by much. It was hot enough to sear the hairs inside my nose. Eyes streaming, we made our way across the room to the back door, now standing open, and more or less fell through into the alleyway behind. Massali and Jenny were crouched in the privy yard of the house on the other side of the alley, both girls now awake and clinging to them, shrieking.
"Where's Fergus?"
Jamie shouted, pushing me toward Massali. She pointed toward the burning building, screaming something that I couldn't hear over the rumble of the fire. Then there was a second's respite in the noise, and a long, panicked bray split the night air.
"Clarence!"
Jamie spun on his heel and ran for the tiny stable, little more than a shed next to the main building. I ran after him, thinking that perhaps the boys had taken refuge there. My bare feet slid on the cobbles, stubbing my toes, but I scarcely noticed, my heart pounding in my ears with fear, lungs laboring to find fresh air.
"Jermaine!"
I heard the shout, faint above the fire, and turned to see a shadow moving just beyond the open door into the kitchen. Smoke was pouring from the door in a thick white column, glowing from the fire beyond. I took a deep gulp of air and dived into the smoke, flailing my arms in a vain effort to dispel enough to see. One of my flailing arms struck something solid, though, and Fergus collapsed into me, so far overcome with heat and smoke that he couldn't stand. I grabbed him under the arms and dragged him toward the door with that sort of strength that comes from the absolute determination not to die. We fell out into the alley, and there were shouts from what proved to be neighbours rushing to help. Hands gripped me and pulled me away. I could hear Fergus gasping and sobbing, struggling against the helpful hands, desperately croaking his son's names. Through streaming eyes, I saw the stable roof alight, and Jamie leading Clarence out, the torn-off sleeve of his shirt wrapped round the mule's eyes. And then I heard a shriek that rose above all the noise, fire, neighbours, Clarence's bray. Massali stood up straight, eyes and mouth round with horror, looking up. The loading door that led to the kitchen loft was open, smoke and sparks fuming out, and in the midst of it was Jermaine, dragging Henri Christian by the hand. He shouted something, but no one could hear above the racket. There was a muffled boom from the loft as another cask went, and the fire blazed up suddenly as the stacks of paper caught, silhouetting the boys in the doorway.
"Jump! Jump!" Jamie was shouting,
and everyone else in the alley was shouting it too, people shoving one another in the effort to get underneath to help. Jermaine looked wildly to and fro. Henri Christian was panicked, struggling to go back into the loft. The rope used to raise and lower loads to a waiting wagon was there, almost within reach. Jermaine saw it and let go of Henri Christian for an instant to reach for it, hanging on to the edge of the doorframe. He got it, and a gasp went through the crowd. His fair hair was standing on end in the wind from the fire, surrounding his head like flames, and for an instant I thought it was on fire. Henri Christian, dizzy from the smoke, had fallen against the doorframe and was clinging to it. He was too frightened to move. I could see him shaking his head as Jermaine pulled at him.
"Throw him, Jermaine! Throw your brother!"
Fergus was shouting as loudly as he could, his voice cracking with the strain, and several other voices joined in.
"Throw him!"
I saw Jermaine's jaw set hard, and he yanked Henri Christian loose, picked him up, and clutched him with one arm, wrapping the rope around the other.
"No!"
Jamie bellowed, seeing it.
"Jermaine, don't!"
But Jermaine bent his head over his brother's, and I thought I saw his lips move, saying,
"Hold on tight."
And then he stepped out into the air, both hands clinging to the rope, Henri Christian's stocky legs wrapped round his ribs. It happened instantly, and yet so slowly. Henri Christian's short legs lost their grip. Germaine's grab failed, for the little boy was already falling, arms outstretched, in a half-somersault through the smoky air. He fell straight through the sea of upraised hands, and the sound, as his head struck the cobbles, was the sound of the end of the world. Chapter 121. Walking on Coals. September the 19th, 1778. Philadelphia. Even when the world ends, things bloody go on happening. You just don't know what to do about them. Everything smelled of smoke and burning. The air, my hair, Jamie's skin, the ill-fitting gown someone had given me. Even food tasted of ashes. But then it would, wouldn't it, I reflected. It didn't matter. I couldn't eat more than the mouthful or two required for politeness. No one had slept. The print shop had burned to the ground in the small hours. There was nothing to be done but to beat off flying embers and stamp out sparks in an effort to preserve the nearby houses. By a mercy, it hadn't been a windy night. The neighbours had given us shelter, clothes, food, and abundant sympathy. None of it seemed real, and I hoped, in a vague sort of way, that this state of things would continue, even though I knew it couldn't. What did seem real, though, was the small collection of vivid images that had been literally seared on my mind during the night. Henri Christian's bare feet, dirty-soled and large in comparison with his legs, sticking out from under his mother's skirt as she cradled him, rocking to and fro, wrapped in a grief too dense for any sound to escape it. Germaine, letting go the rope in a frantic attempt to fly after his brother, dropping like a rock into Fergus's arms. Fergus clutching Germaine so hard against him that it must have bruised them both, his hook gleaming against Germaine's soot-streaked back. The boys had been sleeping on the roof. There was a small trapdoor in the ceiling of the bedroom loft, which no one had remembered in the panic of the fire. When Germaine began finally to talk, sometime toward dawn, he said they had gone out to be cool and to look at the stars. They had fallen asleep and not waked until the slates they lay on began to feel hot, and by then smoke was rolling up through the cracks of the trapdoor. They'd run across the roof to the other side, where a similar trapdoor let them into the printing loft. Half the loft had fallen away and the rest was on fire, but they'd made it through the smoke and rubble to the loading door. "Why?" he cried, passing from one set of arms to another, ignoring all futile words of would-be comfort. "Why didn't I hold on to him? He was too little. He couldn't hold on." Only his mother hadn't embraced him. She held Henri Christian. I wouldn't let go until daylight came, and sheer exhaustion loosened her grasp. Fergus and Jamie had eased the small, chunky body from her grip and taken him away to be washed and made decent for the long business of being dead. Then Massali had come to find her eldest son and touched him gently in his deadened sleep, sorrowing. The Reverend Fig had once more come to our aid, a small, neat figure in his black suit and high white stock, offering his church in which to hold the wake. I was sitting in the church now, in mid-afternoon, alone on a bench with my back against the wall, smelling smoke and trembling intermittently with echoes of flame and loss. Massali was asleep in a neighbour's bed. I had tucked her in, her daughters curled up on either side of her. Félicité sucking her thumb, round black eyes watchful as those of her rag doll, fortuitously saved from the flames. So few things had survived. I remember the constant pang of loss after the big house had burned, reaching for something, and realizing that it wasn't there. Jenny, worn to the grey-white colour of weathered bone, had gone to lie down at the Fig's house, her rosary in her hands, the wooden beads sliding smoothly through her fingers as she walked, her lips moving silently. I doubted that she would stop praying, even in her sleep. People came and went, bringing things. Tables, extra benches, platters of food, late summer flowers, roses and jasmine, and early blue asters. And for the first time, tears ran down my cheeks at this scented remembrance of the wedding held here so little time before. I pressed a stranger's handkerchief to my face, though, not wanting anyone to see and feel they must try to comfort me. The bench beside me creaked and gave, and I peeked over the edge of my handkerchief to see Jamie beside me, wearing a worn suit that plainly belonged to a chairman. It had a band round the coat sleeve reading 82, and with his face washed, but the walls of his ears still grimed with soot. He took my hand and held it tight, and I saw the blisters on his fingers, some fresh, some burst and shredded from the efforts to save what could be saved from the fire. He looked to the front of the church, toward what couldn't be saved, then sighed and looked down to our clasped hands.
"All right, lass."
His voice was hoarse, his throat raw and soot-choked as my own.
"Yes," I said.
"Have you had anything to eat?" I already knew he hadn't slept. He shook his head and leaned back against the wall, closing his eyes, and I felt the relaxation of his body into momentary exhaustion. There were things still to be done, but just for a moment. I wanted to dress his hands, but there was nothing to dress them with. I lifted the hand he held and kissed his knuckles.
"What do you think it's like when you die?"
he asked suddenly, opening his eyes and looking down at me. His eyes were red as an emery bag. "I can't say I've really thought about it," I replied, taken aback.
"Why?"
He rubbed two fingers slowly between his brows. I thought from the look of him that his head must ache.
"I only wondered if it's like this."
He made a brief gesture, encompassing the half-empty room, the well-wishers coming and going in whispers, the mourners sitting blank-faced and sagging like bags of rubbish, stirring with a visible effort, only when spoken to.
"If you dinna ken what to do, and you dinna want much to do anything, what is it like going to sleep and waking up in a new, fresh place? And wanting to go out at once and see what it's like?"
According to Father O'Neill, innocents are just in the presence of God immediately. No limbo, no purgatory. Assuming they were properly baptized, I added. Henri Christian had indeed been baptized, and as he was not yet seven, the church held that he lacked sufficient sense of reason to commit sins. Ergo, "I've known people in their 50s who had less sense than Henri Christian," I said, wiping my nose for the 1,000th time. My nostrils were as raw as my eyelids.
"Aye, but they've more capacity for causing harm with their foolishness."
A faint smile touched his mouth.
"I thought I was dead on Culloden Field. Did I ever tell you that?"
"I don't think you did. Under the circumstances, I suppose it would have been a reasonable assumption, though. Were you knocked out?" He nodded, eyes fixed on the floorboards.
"Aye. If I'd been able to look about, I should have known better. But my eyes were sealed shut with the blood. It was all red and dim, so I supposed I was in purgatory and would just have to wait till someone came round to chastise me. After a bit, I supposed boredom was meant to be part of the punishment."
He glanced at the tiny coffin on its bench at the front of the room. Germaine sat by it, one hand on its lid. He hadn't moved at all in the last half hour. "I've never seen Henri Christian bored," I said quietly after a moment. "Not once."
"No,"
Jamie said softly, and took my hand.
"I dinna suppose he ever will be."
Garlic wakes have their own rhythm. Fergus and the Sally came in quietly an hour or so later, and sat together at first, holding hands near the coffin. But as more people came, the men gradually surrounded Fergus, absorbing him, much as a gang of phagocytes surround a microbe, carrying it along with them. And after a time, as happens normally in such situations, Half the men were at one side of the room talking quietly, and the others outside, unable to bear close quarters and exigent emotion, but wanting to lend their presence and sympathy. The women clustered first near Missali, hugging and weeping, then gathering in small clumps with their friends, drifting back to the tables to rearrange things or put out more bread or cakes. Josiah Prentice came with his fiddle, but left it in its case for the time being. Tobacco smoke from the pipes of the men outside drifted through the church in soft blue clouds. It tickled uneasily at the back of my nose, too reminiscent of the fire for comfort. Jamie left me with a brief squeeze of the hand and went to speak to Ian. I saw them both look at Germaine. Ian nodded and moved quietly to his nephew, putting both hands on his shoulders. Rachel hovered nearby, dark eyes watchful. The bench beside me creaked, and Jenny sat down. Wordless, she put her arm about my shoulder, and equally wordless, I bent my head to hers. And we wept for a bit, not only for Henri Christian, but for the babies we each had lost. My stillborn Faith, her infant Caitlin, and for Missali, now joining us in this sorrowful kinship. The night drew in. Beer and ale were poured. Some stronger drink was brought out, and the somber mood of the gathering lifted a little. Still, it was the wake of a child, and a life cut short. There couldn't be the sense of shared memory and laughter that there might be for a man who had lived a full life, and whose friends had come to share in his death. Josiah Prentice played his fiddle, but quietly, mixing laments with peaceful tunes, and the occasional hymn. There wouldn't be much singing tonight. I wished suddenly and fiercely that Roger were here. He would perhaps have known what to say in a situation where there was nothing one could say. And even with his ruined voice, he would have known a song to sing, a prayer to offer. Father O'Neill from St. George's Church had come, tactfully overlooking the unorthodox Quaker marriage of a month before, and stood talking near the door with Fergus and a few other men. "Poor wee child," Jenny said, her voice roughened by tears, but steady now. She was holding my hand and I hers, and she was looking, not at the coffin, but at Fergus. "His bairns mean everything to him, and especially our wee man." Her lips trembled, but she pressed them together and straightened her back. "Do you think Marsali's breeding?" she said, very softly looking at Missali, with Joan and Félicité clinging to her skirts, Joan's head in her lap. Her mother's hand rested on her hair, gently smoothing it. "I do," I said, as softly. She nodded, and her hand twitched, half hidden in the folds of her skirt, making the horns against evil. More people had come. The Congress was meeting in Philadelphia, and several delegates who did business with Fergus had come. Jonas Phillips and Samuel Adams were both there, chatting by the refreshments table. In a different frame of mind, I might have marvelled at being in the same room with two signers of the Declaration of Independence. But after all, they were only men, though I took it kindly that they'd come. I looked for Germaine every few minutes. Now he was standing by the tables with Ian, drinking something from a cup. I blinked and looked again. Jesus, it... I mean, good Lord, Ian's giving Germaine cherry bounce. Jenny glanced at Germaine's bright red lips, and a quiver of amusement ran through her. "Can I think of anything better for the lad just now? Can you?" "Well, no." I stood up, shaking out my skirts. "Do you want some?" "I do," she said, and got up with alacrity. "And maybe a wee bite, too. It'll be a long night. We'll need a bit to sustain us, aye?" It felt better to be up and moving. The fog of grief still numbed sensation, and I didn't look forward to its passing. But at the same time, I realized that I was hungry now. The feeling in the room shifted gradually from the first impact of shock and sorrow to comforting support for the family, and now to more general talk. Which was, I realized uneasily, beginning to focus on speculation as to what, or who, had caused the fire. In the shock and grief of the event, none of us had spoken of it. But even through that numbing fog, the insidious question had hovered like a bat overhead. Why? How? And who? If anyone. Fire was a common plague in a time when every household had open hearths, and a print shop, with its type forge and its stock of inflammables, was still more vulnerable to simple accident. An open window, a stray breeze, loose papers blowing, a spitting ember from a badly smoured fire catching hold. And yet, the memory of the anonymous letter floated queasily on the surface of my mind. Your house is on fire, and your children are gone. And the young men who had followed me from Chestnut Street, their stealthy plucking and whispered taunts. God, could I have brought their enmity to Fergus's door? Jamie had come to stand by me again, steady and solid as a rock, and handed me a fresh cup of cherry bounce. It was like drinking very strong cough syrup, but it was undeniably bracing. Up to the point where you fell down insensible, at least. I saw that Germain had slid slowly down the wall. Rachel knelt next to him and eased him to the ground, then folded her shawl and put it under his head. The cherry bounce was taking the place of the fog. I thought drunkenness was probably an improvement, on the whole. Mrs. Fraser. A strange voice on my left drew my attention from bemused contemplation of the dark red depths of my cup. A young man in shabby clothes was standing at my elbow, a small package in his hand.
She is, Jamie said, giving the young man a searching look. Are you needing a physician? Because... Oh, no, sir, the young man assured him, obsequious. I was told to give this into Mrs. Fraser's hand, that's all.
He handed it to me, and with a short bow, turned and left. Puzzled and slow with fatigue, grief, and cherry bounce, I fumbled with the string, then gave up and handed the package to Jamie, who reached for his knife, failed to find it, for it had, of course, perished in the fire, and with a flicker of annoyance simply broke the string. The wrapping fell open to reveal a small leather purse and a note, folded but unsealed. I blinked and squinted for a moment, then dipped a hand into my pocket. By a miracle, my spectacles had been downstairs, left behind in the kitchen when I took them off while chopping onions, and Jamie had retrieved them in his hurried foray into the burning house. The stylish handwriting sprang into reassuring clarity.
Mrs. Fraser, I cannot think my presence would be welcome, and I would not intrude on private grief. I ask nothing, neither acknowledgement nor obligation. I do ask that you would allow me to help in the only way that I can, and that you will not reveal the source of this assistance to the younger Mr. Fraser. I trust your discretion, as to the elder.
It was signed simply, P. Wainwright, Beauchamp. I raised my brows at Jamie and passed him the note. He read it, lips pressed tight together, but glanced at Massali and the girls, now clustered with Jenny, talking to Mrs. Phillips, all of them crying quietly. Then across the room to Fergus, flanked by Ian and Rachel. He grimaced very briefly, but his features set in resignation. There was a family to provide for. He couldn't, for the moment, afford pride. Well, it probably wasn't him then, I said with a sigh, and tucked the little purse into the pocket under my skirt. Numbed as I was, I still felt a vague sense of relief at that. Whatever he might be, might have done, or might intend, I still rather liked the erstwhile Monsieur Beauchamp. I had no time to consider Percy further, though, for at this point there was a stir among the people near